Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining me today is my good friend, Dr. Daryl Bricker, the CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs, one of the world's leading polling organizations, to give us an update on global public opinion on a whole bunch of hot topics from the U.S. elections to Russia, China, Israel, and more. He also advises on the stellar annual agenda at the Halifax International Security Forum. That's one of the world's finest global security conferences held each year, the week before Thanksgiving, or the weekend before Thanksgiving, in one of the world's coolest cities, Halifax, Nova Scotia. Daryl, welcome back to the show. Great to have you back on, and looking forward to seeing you in Halifax later this year.
Thanks, Vago. I'm looking forward to seeing you too. Thanks for having me on.
Indeed, an absolute pleasure. And before we get started, the Defense and Aerospace Report and all its publications are brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Daryl, I know you guys are doing polling on just about everything all the time. Nowhere is there more interest than the U.S. presidential race between the same two candidates that ran against each other in 2020, Joe Biden and Donald Trump. In that recent election, Joe Biden won by more than 10 million popular votes, but a very narrow electoral margin. In fact, his margin over Donald Trump, if I remember assessments correctly, was actually smaller than Donald Trump's victory over Hillary Clinton. So this election, you know, as you noted, both in 16 and in 20, would be a small number of people are going to decide, and maybe that pool is shrinking even more. Third-party candidates made a difference in 2020 and certainly in 2016. And now we've got a third-party candidate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's about to announce his running mate, expected to be Democratic mega donor Nicole Shanahan, but we'll see whether that happens, could take away votes. And indeed, it looks like he might be taking more votes away from Biden, which is one of the reasons his family keeps urging him, don't run. What did the presidential dynamics look like this time around? And how big a role are the third-party candidates, whether it's Jill Stein, whether it's RFK Jr. and others, going to play in it? As many voters say, hey, I don't like either of these candidates. They're two old guys who I don't think represent me.
Well, as we've seen in the last two elections, it is a game of inches. And it looks to be a game of inches again. And at this point, public opinion environment slightly favoring Donald Trump, both in terms of his small lead that he has in the national polls, but also he does seem to be doing pretty well in the battleground states. But really what's working to his advantage is the issue set. So what Americans are concerned about are issues that he represents as the best solution to American voters on, as opposed to his opponent, the incumbent president, Joe Biden. So at the moment, it's advantage Trump. The only question that really remains, the one I'd say that we're looking at the most, is whether or not that issue set changes, as opposed to whether or not opinions of the two principal protagonists change, because I think they're pretty set. People who like Joe Biden aren't going to change their minds about him very much. If they dislike him, they're not going to change their minds very much. It's the same with Donald Trump. Yes, you can talk about some of the legal cases having some impact, but some of that might already be baked in. So the real question is whether or not the issues that are driving how people are evaluating the candidates and the electoral choices, whether or not they're going to change between now and Election Day. And every day it gets harder for that to happen.
Is there a way to quantify the third party impact and whether, for example, right? I mean, some Democrats say that RFK Jr. is taking 70% from Democrats of his support and 30% from Trump. At first, the perception is he was taking more from Trump voters. And as you've observed, right? I mean, among Trump voters, there's a lot of shyness, right? They don't publicly say they support him. I know that to be the case across probably about a dozen people who I know that I've discussed this with. What's your sense on what that impact might be?
Polling Trump's numbers has been a challenge for the research industry. You know, in the last election and in 2016 in particular, being able to get it right in the key battleground states has been a challenge. So there's that issue that we're dealing with, and it tends to be an underestimation of his level of support. And then the effect of a third-party candidate that really doesn't have a track record in terms of what their likely core vote is going to be, it's very difficult to get that correct too. So could it be a wild card? You know, could Kennedy be a wild card? Could Kennedy hurt the Democrats? Could he hurt the Republicans? I think we're still trying to work all of that out. I'm willing to accept that he's probably, given that there's a lot of Democrats right now who aren't satisfied with Joe Biden as a presidential candidate, including, the New York Times, who keeps running columns about the fact that maybe the Democrats should change horses. But is there a certain number of Democrats that, the Kennedy appeal, just based on the name, could peel away? Maybe. I mean, that could be a problem, but we don't know the effect yet. But all of it, any of this environment that doesn't advantage the incumbent, is a problem for America going forward into the election in November. So it continues to make it very uncertain, which is it makes for a nervous nation, and frankly, makes for a nervous world.
And speaking of that, what are the feedback you're getting, right? Because if Americans, right, a signature democracy decides that Donald J. Trump should be its president again, means a comfort level with his policies, right? I mean, unfortunately, whether you like it or not, the leadership is a reflection of the people, and it doesn't matter if his name is Ahmadinejad or Trump or Marine Le Pen, ultimately, or Boris Johnson. What have you guys quantified what the international impact will be, given how concerned people are abroad about the former president returning to office?
Well, we saw quite clearly the last time he was elected in 2016. We have a very interesting test period, 2016 through to 2020, and then to today. So one of the questions that we ask for the Halifax International Security Forum every year is, do you think this following list of countries and organizations will have a positive or negative effect on world relations over the next few years, or words to that effect? It's questions to asking whether a country and organization is going to have a positive or negative impact on the world. When Barack Obama was president, the United States was kind of the upper mid tier of countries and organizations that we tested. The minute that Donald Trump was elected, the United States, in terms of global reputation on that question, dropped, I believe the number was 14 points, like overnight, and stayed there, fluctuating, 10 points lower than, at least below what it was for Barack Obama, until Joe Biden was elected, and then it moved up to the same back to the same level that Biden was at, or that Obama was at. So literally, you can track the trough. It's double digits, mid-teens, a result overnight that lasted through lasted through to the Biden administration. So my expectation, since we already have an example of what the effect is that you'll see something less. Now, Barack Obama was certainly more admired on a global basis than Joe Biden, and there's a lot of crises that are taking place right now in the world in which people are actually asking about American motivations under Joe Biden. So maybe if Trump wins, it doesn't go down quite as much, but my expectation is it will still go down a fairly significant number.
And let me take you to the question of what the American electorate cares about, right? What is your polling telling you about what the most important issues are? Because the Biden team will tell you there's an improving economy, red hot economy, actually. Unemployment is down, inflation is decreasing, and yet voters are still saying, well, I'm not economically satisfied with my lot, for which there are a lot of other drivers, ultimately. What are you guys seeing that may be driving the electorate in this case? Or is it just, identification politics? I identify with Donald Trump, I identify with Joe Biden.
No, it is issues based. So the economy is still at the top of the list in the United States, although coming down a little bit, probably as a result of some of what you just mentioned. But immigration is very much up there too, and both of those issues are not issues that the Biden administration does well on. So it's not that people are on the economy are saying Joe Biden is doing a great job, and therefore I'm changing my mind about Joe Biden. It's that the issue of the economy isn't as salient as it was, say, for example, 6 months ago. So some of the heat is coming out of that, but it's still at the top of the list. And when people are talking about the economy, they're talking about cost of living. They're not talking about statistics on, the front page of the Wall Street Journal. That's not how people experience the economy. That's how commentators talk about it, like it's almost like they're watching, sports scores. The economy is more of a feeling for most people. than it is an actual, dollars and cents quantifiable sort of thing. And people in the United States right now really do feel that the country's not headed in the right direction, and their feeling of hope about the future and for them and their families is certainly diminished as a result of that. But then it's so the economy is coming down. Immigration is certainly there. It's still right near the top of the list. Clearly a hot button issue for Republicans. For Democrats, fairly divided on this issue. Independents tend to be more aligned with the Republicans on it. And as immigration sits at the top of the list, it's not because people are changing their mind about it. It's because they're just satisfied. The one issue that we have started to see move a bit up is the issue of protection of democracy in the United States, a big issue for Democrats. So if we see that issue, sort of the January 6th type conversation, move its way up in terms of salience, the improvement of the potential for the Democrats definitely takes place. But if it doesn't move up and we're talking about the economy and we're talking about immigration going into this election, it's advantage Donald Trump.
And I just want to apologize to the audience because there may be some background noise. There's work going on the building. What I find absolutely fascinating is that now that Donald Trump is the presumptive nominee, the number of people who said they wouldn't support him are now supporting him, as well as voters who'd said, well, you know, if there are criminal indictments or if he gets convicted, I wouldn't vote for him, shifting to, well, he's going to be the candidate and I'm going to vote for him. And again, that sort of shy voter part of it, I think, you know, the White House is right. The polling numbers aren't right. My observation would be that those polling numbers for Donald Trump might actually be reflecting lower than what they actually are, given the reluctance to tell, you know, even a polling, an august polling organization, I'm going to go in the booth and pull the lever for the guy, right?
Yeah, all of the polling organizations have had the same issue. Trump is hard to estimate. But let me just say on those, there's two issues like this right now, Vago. One of them is the justice issue in Donald Trump, and the other one is the age issue in Joe Biden. And the question that I don't think has been answered adequately at the moment is whether a person saying, I think Joe Biden is too old to be running for president, actually keeps them from voting for him. You can actually perform both acts. You can think he's old, and it's not necessarily correlated to how you're going to vote because it's really a choice between Trump and Biden, not younger and older Joe Biden. So that the age issue tends to get a lot of attention, and I don't know how correlated it is to whether or not people will vote for Biden or not. It's the same thing with the justice issue for Trump. There's kind of a right answer to that question. So, somebody who has a criminal conviction be running for president? The answer, probably for most Americans, is no. But that doesn't necessarily mean that in the choice between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, because one is criminally convicted and the other isn't, that I'm going to change my vote when it comes to November. So, there's a lot of these questions that come up through the course of looking at the political situation, in which the answer seems really strong. But the correlation to how people are going to make their choice is actually quite weak. So I think the criminal case thing is kind of factored in, and I don't know that it's going to convictions, as much as the media goes on about this, are necessarily going to have that big an effect on Trump on voting day. And it's the same thing, I think, for age for Biden. It may not have as big an effect as some people are thinking at the moment. I mean, we'll see as it gets closer, but I think that these are two issues that get a bit exaggerated in the analysis.
What I find fascinating as somebody who has to listen to what both of these men have to say on a regular basis, I find it interesting that the occasional slip-ups Biden make big headlines. The punchlines Trump delivers maybe accurately get covered, but the rambling, disconnected nature of a lot of the other things he says tend not to be picked up on, right? And so it's an interesting juxtaposition. Of how the thing is covered, and then in turn shapes how the what you know how the electorate actually think about the two candidates, their vim and vigor. It is fascinating.
Yeah, when you go out and you take a look at it, though, it's pretty clear that age is not a disadvantage for Donald Trump in the minds of voters. It is something that people are thinking about when it comes to Joe Biden. I just don't know if it's the type of thing that would prevent people from voting for him.
Indeed. Let me just shift to a broader issue and start to get international, because we've got a lot of the world to cover in the short amount of time we've got left. Speaking of elections, you guys also have been doing some interesting work on European parliamentary elections. There have been worries over the past few decades about the rise of the right in Europe. Their messages on immigration, excess regulation from Brussels, and other populist causes have been resonating with voters in the United Kingdom. We saw the UK Independence Party and that drove Brexit. We've seen Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. He's not going to be prime minister, but his party, once in the wilderness, is now front and center as a potential kingmaker. You've got Alternative for Deutschland, which has gained seats and legitimacy. And Marine Le Pen's National Rally has gone from, right-wing kook, fascist fringe to potentially the next president of France. What does the European electoral map look like, and what are these trends? Because some say the threat from the right is overblown. Others say they're just legitimizing, tendencies that got us into World War II the last time.
Well, you can the long history view may very well be that, but in the immediate political situation, we are seeing a cycle of the right growing, in all the places that you mentioned, in other countries as well. But coincidental with that is we're also seeing the decline of particularly the far left and the green political choices as well. So it's not just the rise of the more nativist nationalist right. We're also seeing the decline of what had been a fairly dominant stream in modern European politics, which is that stronger progressive green coalition of voters that seem to be out there. What we're seeing, though, is with the rise of the right, it is a relative rise, but not a decisive rise. So, is it going to change the balance of decision making in the European Parliament? Well, there's going to be more people on the right. The conservative middle strand is probably going to end up ruling again, but certainly there's going to be a stronger presence from the right, but it will not be a controlling presence. At least that's not what it's showing in the polling right now. The more interesting stories, I think, on the right are not necessarily in aggregate. I think that they're really more in specific circumstances, and the ones that you mentioned are really interesting. So the decision-making aspect of what would exist on the more radical right could be expressed in things like, for example, the next French presidential election, or coalition governments that are created in places like Holland. What's happening in Italy right now with their government that's definitely certainly more right than we've seen any time since the end of the Second World War. So there are all sorts of things that are happening in terms of the growth of the right, but it's not decisive at a European level at the moment.
And in terms of what are the issues that are driving Europeans, are they similar to the United States, with immigration sort of being at the top of that list? I mean, immigration is also an increasing important issue in Canada, for example, right?
So immigration is definitely up there. But also it's the reaction to climate regulations from both local governments and central governments. So you're also seeing the rise of like we did in Holland, actually the election before the last election, the rise of the farmers movement there. There's just a protest in England on the weekend where farmers were bringing their tractors downtown to block streets. We've certainly seen this in Germany. We've seen it in France. We've seen it in other places. But it's also, apart from immigration, the reaction to what people see as kind of like a downtown progressive green type of a movement. People who are living in more rural, smaller town situations, particularly people working in a farm economy, those people are the ones who are really pushing.
Absolutely fascinating on how all of these trends, right? I mean, there are commonality across them, right? A little bit of pushback even in the United States, right? Electric cars are going to take over. Nah, I'm not sure I want to buy electric cars for whatever the reason, right? Range anxiety is part of it. I don't like Elon Musk is another part of it. Oh, there aren't enough chargers, et cetera, right? So, I mean, it's interesting even how in a few short years the dynamic, has a tendency of shifting. Let me take you to the Ukraine war, something that we've talked about before. American support has been very strong, but has been delayed by GOP lawmakers. That logjam may be freeing as Speaker Johnson says, hey, look, we've got to, America has to live by its commitments, which is certainly a welcome statement. This comes as Vladimir Putin is. Blamed ISIS-K for the terror attack in Moscow, the deadly terror attack, but he's also said that Ukraine was behind that attack. Walk us through how support for the war is polling in the United States and around the world, and what the sense of Russia is now that Vladimir Putin enters his fifth 6-year term.
Well, people don't like Russia. I mean, so anything that you're seeing in terms of support or a lack of support for the war in just about any place, except maybe, a fellow traveler like China, where it's very difficult to get accurate public opinion information, is not shouldn't be interpreted as support for the Russian regime. It's just people not thinking that their country should be involved in foreign wars, and also thinking that there's other priorities that they're more concerned about. So when we go out and we do polling on the Ukrainian war, the first thing that we see is that support just about everywhere has for the Ukrainian cause has softened. It's not that they have turned on the Ukrainians, so it's not like they're saying I don't support the Ukrainians. They're fatigued with this war, just like I'm sure the Ukrainians are more than fatigued. And they just it seems like a war that's going on without end, and that there's other priorities on the public purse other than supporting that. So you still get elements of the political leadership that are still very much in that kind of Cold War type of mentality, where it's the Russians, so therefore we have to be opposed. But public opinion is certainly more, I would say, split up than just around that particular point of view. The place where you see support for the Ukrainian supporting the Ukrainian cause strongest tends to be in the places that are closest to Ukraine, where people feel that they might be under attack from Russia if Ukraine doesn't hold. So at the moment, what we're seeing is in the United States softening support for the Ukrainian war, but also in large swaths of the world, we're seeing a similar thing.
Which is very regrettable. I mean, I think it takes some nerve to have war fatigue when you're not actually subjected to the war. They're the ones who are doing the heavy lifting. We're just doing the supporting, and people may get tired of what it is that they're reading, even though, unfortunately, I feel that the Ukraine is slipping farther and farther in the headlines as more folks focus on the Gaza crisis or just get crisis fatigue overall. I want to just ask one quick follow-up to that. One of the concerns with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan was that it will become a haven for terrorism. And in the wake of all of this, we're seeing that ISIS-K has been a threat, right? There have been attacks thwarted elsewhere, but it's not for want of trying for these guys, and they succeeded in Moscow. And there's a concern, and we'll get to Gaza in a minute, that Gaza is going to fuel, unfortunately, and radicalize folks to, unfortunately, head toward terrorism. How does terrorism, right, which has slipped from the headlines and as a focus, even if the entire national security apparatus is working very hard to foil these attempts, how is that factoring into the polling in terms of what it is as kind of a global threat?
Terrorism is one of those issues that is very headline driven. So if there is a terror, and we can see this in the polling that we do for the Halifax International Security Forum, when we started doing the poll a dozen years ago, terrorism was a much bigger priority in terms of global public opinion. Less of a priority now. But when an incident happens in a particular country, you will see the numbers around terrorism as a threat go up. And then over a period of time, 6 months or so, it starts to decline again. If there's one that takes place in which people can really see themselves as having been potential victims themselves, say for example, like 9/11, where that was flashed all over the world and it became a very kind of personalized story, you'll see support for terror support. That's the wrong way of putting it. You will see concern about terrorism start to rise. At the moment, we're not seeing a big increase in terrorism, but concern about terrorism. But what I would say is keep an eye on the news, If you start to see a number of incidents happening all over the world, it'll start to happen. It'll start to move up. And in countries in which something specific happens, say, for example, if we did a poll in Russia today, you'd probably see terrorism has gone up considerably in terms of
Right.
public concerns.
Let me take you to how Israel is polling. Obviously, in the wake of the heinous October 7 attacks, Israel launched its offensive to crush Hamas, and a lot of debate about whether or not that strategy is likely to succeed and whether the human cost of that campaign will be unbearable. Washington is worried that Israel, in its focus on destroying Hamas, is actually undermining its global reputation at a time when it can't afford that. But there will be lasting damage in the wake of this. You and I discussed this in the wake of the last Halifax Forum, where you guys had some interesting findings. What are your findings now that we're talking about 5 months after that, the last temperature taking that you and I did on the war in Israel and its impact on Israel's reputation?
Okay, so Israel tends to be a bottom-tier country when it comes to global reputation at the best of times. So it's not really a country in which they're seen as making a really strong positive contribution to global affairs. And that's any year that you go out and do the survey that we did for the Halifax International Security Forum. By the way, anybody who looks at public opinion polling on this by any organization doing probing these issues will not have any difficulty with what I just said. I mean, it's Israel struggles with its global reputation. What's happened with the war in Gaza is after October the 7th, there was a period of time in which we saw the world kind of, particularly the world that's flexible enough to rally behind Israel, to rally behind Israel to a certain extent. And what we've seen since probably a few weeks after that, it start to decline. So even countries where Israel's could count on having genuine public support, even those places are challenged now. And the reason for that is because people do not like war, and they in particular don't like war in which it appears that a lot of people who are non-combatants are being put into situations that are untenable in terms of their safety and in terms of their security. And that's what seems to be happening in the eyes of public opinion in Gaza right now. So I would say that the evidence would be pretty strong that the reputation of the government of Israel, the longer this goes on, tends to suffer more every day.
And is it repairable, right? I mean, is this, once hostilities cease, that you'll see that number come up? Because one concern that people have is that this will diminish that reputation in a somewhat more lasting fashion.
The potential for that, the longer this goes on, is strong. But also there is a a pretty strong residual reaction also to anti-Semitism.
Right.
So to the extent that this issue is equated with supporting people who have the eradication of Israel and Jews as a as part of their political agenda, you would be wrong to see that the support for or declining support for the government of Israel and its policy in Gaza could be interpreted as rising support for that other thing, because there is no rising support for that.
Indeed, and that's central to the debate, right? If you're being critical of Israel, does that equate to anti-Semitism? What constitutes anti-Semitism, and the debate that goes along with it, unfortunately. Let me take you one last question, which is on China, because I know our time is brief. Perceptions of China have been changing as the country does become more assertive internationally, unfortunately, not necessarily the most positive way. And it's economic chaos is causing also internal dynamics, right? And people to question, okay, well, wait a minute. The Chinese were presenting their model as superior to the Western model, and now it's suffering really badly, in part because it's a centrally directed economy, which has a tendency of sort of working until it doesn't. How are the Chinese polling, and where are they stacking up on that list globally?
Okay, so the Chinese, I think prior to COVID, there were enough places in the world in which China was seen as potentially a competitive governing model to the liberal democratic system, that it was worrisome. And then COVID came along, and the type of drop I described, you know, when Donald Trump came along and the reputation of the United States, China went through exactly the same, even more so. I think they dropped like 20 points. The difference is China's never, it's never come back. So COVID did not do the reputation of China any good, and its militaristic approaches and difficulties in terms of you know, its relationships with its neighbors, and also the things that we've been hearing lately about, you know, spying and industrial espionage, and all of continue to contribute to the fact that China's reputation continues to be about 20 points behind what we saw at its height. So China's suffering. But I must say, Vago, every conversation I have about China that doesn't start with they're going to lose half their population this century, to me, is not a realistic conversation.
Right.
And it's amazing to me how people we I can and I've been on many panels in which people go on about, you know, the short-term economic situation for China and what a threat it represents and all the rest of it. It's like, yes, you're right, but now factor in that they're going to lose half their population this century, starting now, because it started last year.
Right.
Rapidly aging population, they have no social welfare system to take care of. Okay, now let's have that conversation again.
And that was where I was going to end it, right? You and John Ibbotson wrote the tremendous book that I suggest everybody read, Empty Planet: The Shock of Global Population Decline. What does that mean, right? The one-child policy proved to be very successful, and the fear always was the country's going to get old before it gets rich. Young people can't find jobs. Talk to us about the domino effect, and right, if you're a strategic planner and you're looking at China, what is the China we ought to be preparing for, as opposed to the past China that weighs on our mind, right? Where are we going to be in a decade and 2 decades that should shape our policies? Because as you said, it's an emptying country, which can help in one way, but is very problematic in another way, right? You have fewer mouths to feed and fewer people to raise out of poverty. On the other hand, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah, except the fewer people that you have to raise out of poverty and fewer people that you have to feed are all old people. So the China that we need to get ready for is shrinking, aging, and problematic.
That's very succinct. Is there anything else you want to add to that before we end?
Yeah, I mean, no, demography is politics and policy, right? I mean, the first thing to take a look at when you want to understand what a country's future is going to be is take a look at their population. If you've got a population, and I always say this to my American friends, the average Chinese person is older than the average American. China's aging much more rapidly than America is. They have no social welfare. I mean, we can talk about whether or not, you know, Social Security and things and other social services are going to be there for Americans in the future, but at least you have a system. They have nothing in China. They're completely dependent on the families of older people taking care of the older people. And these older people didn't have kids. If they had any, they had one. So you're going to have one kid and two kids who are, if they get married, and by the way, their marriage rates are collapsing too, trying to take care of four older people. They're in very, very difficult economic and social space. And the political implications, nobody can really come to grips with. We can't even really imagine it because the numbers are so big and the trends are so predictable as to what's going to happen. And we just seem to be operating in ignorance of it. And what the implications will be, very difficult to say because nobody's ever had it happen before, particularly nobody at this size and scale, the world's largest country. I mean, when John and I wrote Empty Planet, the Chinese population was supposed to start declining in the mid-2030s. It started last year. Everything is happening very, very, very fast. And China doesn't have the systems in place to be able to take care of this. I mean, China, why did the Chinese economy take off? Well, because it was a place where cheap labor could be used to create an export market. Well, what happens if you have no more cheap laborers? Because labor is young, it's not old. What are they
Right.
going to do? Good question. And by the way, I very rarely hear this conversation. I was on a panel in an economic forum, not the WEF, but another one in last year in June, And I heard some economists from Asia, waxing on about, the future of the 21st century is going to all be about China. My only comment was going to be, well, there's going to be half the Chinese population there is today. So explain to me who that is.
Indeed. Let me ask you just one 30 seconds, although you've been very generous with your time. Where does national security fall on the global stack of issues, right? We've talked about immigration, we've talked about economic challenges. For some, it's social and diversity related. For some, it's climate. Where does national security fall on that spectrum of worries?
It depends on how close you are to a security problem. So if you're next door to somebody who's potentially an invading force, national security is a big issue. So if you live in Poland, you're worried about national security. If you live in the United States and Canada, well, that's not a good comparison. If you live in Canada, not so much. If you live in the United States, since you still see yourself as having a global role, a lesser global role, though, still a fairly big priority, but certainly not as big as the things that are happening in your own individual household, and certainly not as big as things that are happening in your community. So that's why the economy and immigration are at the top of the list right now. National security, quite a bit further down.
Daryl, always an honor and pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so very much. Already looking forward to having you back on again. And until then, keep well, and we'll see you again soon.
Talk to you soon, Vago. Thanks.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it. We'll see you again tomorrow for the AirPower podcast. Until then, have a great day.